Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, including the Colon Cancer Alliance, and we're delighted with this collaboration. It's enabled us to reach so many of you on the call today, and we have over 688 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we have international participants from Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really are from all over the world to some extent, and it's a global call. Today's program is made possible by Bayer Healthcare, Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Lilly. And we really want to thank them for their support of the program as well as their collaboration in making today's program possible. Now, I want to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for you, about our speakers and about the topics they'll be addressing. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to, at the end of the program today, to complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forward? Indeed, this topic, colorectal cancer, is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and we are offering it today, so, and we will offer it again. Just let us know the topics you'd like us to offer. It really helps a great deal to make the programs most relevant to meet your needs. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. David Ryan. Dr. Ryan is Chief Division of Hematology Oncology, Clinical Director, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, Director, Tucker Gosnell Center for Gastrointestinal Cancers, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Ryan is going to present an overview of colorectal cancer, new treatment approaches, and clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ryan.
Thank you, Carolyn. So whenever you're talking about colorectal cancer, I always like to start with a brief anatomy overview. So the colon begins in the right lower quadrant of the abdomen. That's right down, right above your groin on the right side. And the first part of the colon is called the cecum, and that's where the last part of the small intestine inserts into the ileum, goes into the cecum. And then the colon then goes up along your body towards your rib cage on the right-hand side, and then makes a left-hand turn straight across your abdominal wall. And then right when you get to the rib cage on the left side, it goes straight back down to the left lower quadrant, just above the left groin, and then makes a big sweeping S, which is called the sigmoid colon, into your rectum. And the rectum is about the last 6 inches of the colon. And the important difference, the major difference between the colon and the rectum that matters in the treatment of cancer is that the rectum is outside of the peritoneal cavity. Now, the peritoneal cavity is like a big water balloon in which your intestines sit, and the last part of the colon is the rectum, and that rectum is outside of the peritoneal cavity, and it's about 6 inches long. And the reason it's such a big difference, or just one major difference, is that rectal cancers have a much higher rate of coming back locally than do colon cancers. And we always worry about cancers coming back either someplace else, meaning the liver, the lungs, or someplace else in the abdomen, or locally, right where they started. Well, thankfully, it's a very uncommon occurrence for colon cancer to come back locally. But for rectal cancer, that's not the case. And so we also have to think about local therapies like radiation when we think about rectal cancer. Now, most people are diagnosed after a colonoscopy, and the colonoscopist will tell the patient when they wake up that they think they found a cancer. And most times, patients will get referred at that point to a surgeon. And for a colon cancer, surgery is the mainstay of therapy. Sometimes with rectal cancer, though, because we are worried about local control of that cancer, we will administer radiation at the start of therapy as opposed to surgery. So how do we make those determinations? Well, the first thing we need to do is something called stage the patient. We need to complete the staging studies. And typically that consists of getting CT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. For somebody with a stage 1 colon cancer, we go straight to surgery. For somebody with a stage 2 colon cancer, we go straight to surgery as well. And then we may have a long discussion about chemotherapy, the pros and cons of chemotherapy after that. For somebody with stage 3 colon cancer, they go straight to surgery, and then we typically do recommend that everybody with stage 3 colon cancer get a course of chemotherapy. And then for stage 4 colon cancer, the conversation can be quite complicated. We often will recommend that patients begin with chemotherapy, but there still may be a role for surgery and there still may be a role for radiation. But typically we will start with chemotherapy. The only difference, as I said earlier, for rectal cancer is that we will often incorporate radiation for stage 2 and 3 rectal cancer. For stage 1 rectal cancer, we don't need to incorporate radiation, and those patients can go straight to surgery. Now, the chemotherapy regimens that we typically use for colorectal cancer have a backbone, and that backbone are usually referred to in their acronym form. The acronyms are FOLFOX and FOLFIRI. They're both European acronyms, and they don't really make much sense in English, but FOLFOX consists of three drugs, 5-FU and oxaliplatin, with a B vitamin called leucovorin. And FOLFIRI consists of three drugs, 5-FU and irinotecan, with the same B vitamin, leucovorin. We will often combine those regimens, those combination chemotherapy regimens, with a biologic therapy, either a treatment that targets the VEGF pathway called bevacizumab or Avastin, or a treatment that targets the EGFR pathway, the epidermal growth factor receptor pathway, called cetuximab or panitumumab. All of these regimens are antibodies that target these specific pathways. And we use these drugs in combination to treat somebody's cancer. Now, why we use one regimen over another regimen has to do with side effects. It has to do with the tolerability of that an individual patient has to that particular chemotherapy. And it also has to do with the genetics underlying a person's type of cancer. So nowadays, everybody who has stage 4 colon cancer has to have their tumor tested for specific genetic mutations that occur specifically within the tumor. These are not any genetic mutations that you are born with, but these are genetic mutations that we actually find in the tumor from the biopsy or the surgical resection that you underwent. And those mutations are things like KRAS and BRAF and NRAS, and Dr. Saltz is going to speak to those later on. But they play a role in the types of treatment that we pick for folks with colon cancer in the stage 4 setting. Now, when you come to a doctor with colon cancer, there's always three options. One option is to do the surgery and then to watch the cancer. That can be an option. The second option is to do what the standard chemotherapy is. And the third option is to participate in a clinical trial. Most clinical trials evaluating patients in the stage 4 colon cancer setting are evaluating new drugs, and most of the new drugs that we're trying are targeting specific mutations, new mutations that we're finding in those biopsies and surgical specimens where we think a specific pathway is getting revved up. And we're trying out a drug either in combination with our known chemotherapy regimens or even alone where we're trying to shut down that specific pathway. And so anytime you have colon cancer, it's always good to ask, are there any clinical trials that are appropriate for me? And I'm going to stop there and turn it back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Ryan. That was a wonderful introduction to the call and overview. Thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Leonard Saltz. Dr. Saltz is Chief Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Head Colorectal Oncology Section, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Saltz is going to address KRAS and targeted cancer therapies, controlling symptoms, treatment side effects and pain, nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. Again, it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Saltz.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. So let me pick up where Dr. Ryan left off and discuss a little bit about KRAS and the other markers that we're using to understand tumors. And again, this is specific to patients with metastatic or stage 4 disease. We at present don't really have a role for using these markers in selecting who to treat or what to treat with in earlier stage disease. But for stage 4 disease, by the time a person has cancer of the colon that's metastasized to another organ, we need these molecular markers to guide our therapy. It doesn't necessarily affect what the first therapy will be, but it affects our thinking over the continuum of care because we're going to be using multiple drugs. We know that no one drug or one drug combination is going to be enough to control the problem, and one day that first choice of chemotherapy that we've made will stop working, and we need to be thinking down the road what's plan B and what's plan C and so on. So RAS proteins are proteins involved in what we call signal transduction. What that means is that tumor cells receive signals from the outside world in the form of chemicals called growth factors that bind to receptors on the surface of the cell. And that sends a signal into the nucleus of the cell that tells the cell to do things we don't want it to do, like grow and survive and metastasize. The way that the signal gets from that receptor on the surface down to the nucleus is a bit of a puzzle, and that area is called signal transduction, and we're starting to understand that better and better. And we're learning that if some of the proteins involved in the signaling chain or signaling cascade are mutated, that means that some of our drugs won't work. And David specifically referred to two drugs, cetuximab and panitumumab. Those are the generic names just for purpose of clarity. The brand names of those are Erbitux and Vectibix. They're two very similar molecules made by two different companies that target a specific receptor called the epidermal growth factor receptor. These drugs are often used either as single agents or in combination with chemotherapy, and they only work or only have a chance to work if the signal transduction proteins that we know how to look for are what we call wild type or normal as opposed to mutated. So we look for RAS mutations, and the most common type of RAS mutation is a type called KRAS. In colon cancer. We also see another type of RAS mutation called NRAS, and we've learned that any of these RAS mutations, if they're present in the tumor, means that these drugs, Erbitux and Vectibix or cetuximab and panitumumab, not only will not work, but might actually be counterproductive and might actually make the tumors grow faster. So it's very important to have this information before we consider using these drugs. Now, one of the almost universal side effects of these drugs is a fairly unpleasant skin rash. The rash looks like a really bad case of acne, and it is not acne. It's actually a dry rash, and we treat it with moisturizers. We sometimes try to treat it with antibiotics, but the harsh reality is, for reasons we don't understand, there is a correlation between developing the rash and benefiting from the drug, and people that don't get a substantial skin rash don't get any benefit from these drugs. For this reason, I don't recommend the use of these drugs as a first-line therapy or part of a first-line therapy, even in patients who have a non-mutated or wild-type RAS gene. Now, not all oncologists agree with that opinion, and it is within acceptable practice to use them up front. They are effective. I don't believe that they are more effective or less effective than the alternatives, and the data would support that opinion, but this is my personal approach to the disease, trying to minimize the skin rash until we really don't have other options, because that rash is a difficult thing for patients to tolerate. David also mentioned the signal transduction protein BRAF. BRAF is next in line below RAS, and what we found is if there is a mutation in BRAF, it means two things. One, unfortunately, is it means that the tumors tend to be more aggressive and less sensitive to chemotherapy in general. And two, it means for all practical purposes that these EGFR inhibitors, cetuximab and panitumumab, are extremely unlikely to work. And so I don't use those agents in patients whose tumors have a BRAF mutation. One of the important things to understand, these mutations that we're talking about are mutations in the tumor, not in the patient. So these are not things that are in the normal cells in the body. They're not things that can be passed to offspring. These are mutations acquired by the cancer themselves. So I hope that gives you a little bit of overview. If there are questions, we can discuss that going forward. I wanted to talk a little bit about controlling symptoms, side effects, and also get into some nutritional aspects because these are very important in terms of patient care. One of the scariest things about chemotherapy is the idea of nausea and vomiting. That's the side effect that patients are afraid of the most. And fortunately, that's one of the areas where I think we've made the most progress over the past three or four decades in terms of really substantially improving the control of that symptom. And with current anti-nausea medicines, most patients being treated for colorectal cancer will have only modest or non-existent problems with nausea. We give these medicines routinely in advance, and then we usually have supplemental medicines that people can take in addition if necessary. As far as controlling symptoms of pain, that's something that's extremely important, requires a lot of communication, as Dr. Ocean is going to talk to you about shortly. There are very effective pain medicines, but they need to be individually titrated and adjusted for patient needs. We don't want to undertreat pain because that's obviously going to make somebody miserable. On the other hand, if we overtreat, we can have problems with people being over-sedated and confused. So we really have to work to strike a balance, and it requires a lot of active communication back and forth between the patient and the doctor. Now, nutrition is one of the really important aspects in terms of care of colorectal cancer because, one, it matters, and two, it's really something that patients can take control of. These are often the kinds of situations where people are asking, what can I do to optimize my care, to give myself the best chance? Well, a very interesting study was published by our colleague Jeff Meyerhart at Dana-Farber. And this goes back to a study that I led a number of years ago where we were looking at different treatments, two different treatments in stage 3 patients. And we gave very detailed questionnaires to people 3 and 12 months after their surgery for stage 3 disease. And then we looked back 5 years later and saw whose cancer stayed away and whose cancer came back. And based on the surveys where we asked people what they ate, what they drank, what they smoked, what they took, we got some very interesting information. And we found that patients who ate what we called a prudent diet, which I'll explain in a moment, had a substantially better chance of remaining cancer-free than people who ate what we call a Western diet. Now, the Western diet was basically junk food diet, breakfast at Dunkin' Donuts, lunch at McDonald's, and dinner at Burger King sort of thing, whereas the prudent diet was high in fresh fruits and vegetables, low in red meat and animal fat, and that includes low in dairy fat, high in whole grain, and low in refined grain, and low in refined sugars. And what we found is that we looked at the quintile, the top fifth of patients that were best at keeping to that prudent diet versus the lowest quintile who were closest to the Western diet, and there was actually a 50% risk reduction in terms of the chance of the cancer coming back. So really compelling evidence, I think, that diet can help patients improve their health and improve their body's ability to fight off cancer. We also looked at exercise and found that patients who got what was essentially the metabolic equivalent of an hour of walking a day, we're not talking about training for the marathon, but just maintaining reasonable degrees of physical activity, had a 30% decrease in the risk of their cancer coming back. So again, evidence that moderate aerobic exercise on a regular basis and prudent diet adjustments can make a difference for patients who are fighting off a cancer. And these are the kinds of lifestyle changes that we recommend for all our patients. So I'm just about out of time, so I'm going to stop there and I'll be happy to take any questions later.
Thank you very much, Dr. Salt. Excellent overview of important issues here for people to be aware of, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Allison Ocean, and Dr. Ocean is Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, the J. Monahan Center for Gastrointestinal Health, New York Presbyterian Hospital, Cornell. And Dr. Ocean is going to address communicating with your healthcare team and the importance of a multidisciplinary approach to your care. Dr. Ocean?
Thank you for allowing me to participate in this very unique conference call highlighting the treatment aspects of colon cancer and all the advances that have happened over the last few decades. My goal is to talk about multidisciplinary care in colon cancer, and this is a very important treatment aspect, and I'll just start by introducing what the concept is of multidisciplinary care. What that means is an organizational unit of doctors and specialists from all different specialties who collaborate to focus on caring for patients with colorectal cancer. So a multidisciplinary care team can exist in a large hospital or a small hospital. All it means is that many different specialists get together to collaborate and focus on caring for the cancer that you have. And it usually starts with meeting this team of doctors when you're first diagnosed with colorectal cancer. And this team of doctors usually are comprised of a surgeon, as was outlined with the anatomy that Dr. Ryan discussed before. A surgeon is going to order diagnostic tests, perform a biopsy, perform surgery, et cetera, and that's why they're a valuable part of the treatment team. Medical oncologists, which I am, and Dr. Saltz and Dr. Ryan are all medical oncologists. We administer chemotherapy. We administer targeted therapies, immunotherapies, all aim to reduce the cancer burden, to kill cancer cells, all these treatments, and also to we administer medications to help patients deal with the side effects of treatments. Another important member of the multidisciplinary care team is the radiation oncologist. Treatment of rectal cancer usually involves radiation. The radiation oncologist is a physician who designs the treatment plan for radiation. This is when a directed beam of radiation is given to the rectum, to the cancer area, to work at the cancer, to kill the cancer, to shrink it down. And the radiation oncologist plans precisely where the radiation beams will go in the body, and to use precisely focused x-rays to reduce or to destroy the tumor. All of these cancer specialists, in addition to the nurses that are part of the team, the social worker that's part of the team, the nutritionist, the geneticist, the primary care doctor, all of these members are part of the multidisciplinary treatment team that will work with patients when they are going through colon cancer treatment and colorectal cancer treatment. And this, and the point of all of this is to having all of your specialists there to create the most appropriate and effective treatment plan for your cancer. So when someone is given the diagnosis of colorectal cancer, it's very overwhelming at first. Patients feel lost. They don't know what to do. They're very scared. This may be the first time they're ever dealing with cancer, or even if they have a relative that has dealt with cancer in the past, it may be a different cancer. So they don't know what to expect, or they're expecting a bad experience that a relative or a friend may have had, but was a different cancer. So obviously the thoughts are going wild, and people are very anxious and scared when they get a new diagnosis. So knowing that your treatment is being conducted by a team of doctors and specialists and nurses and supportive care professionals really helps to ease the anxiety of patients, because that they'll understand that they'll be able to receive the best care available. So I want to transition into talking about how to communicate with your doctor once you do get a diagnosis of colorectal cancer. What are the important questions that you want to ask, and what, where you should go to look for resources and for help in this matter. So the first thing to do is, you know, you're usually going to get referred to a to an oncologist or to a specialist or a surgeon. And my best advice, and what patients have told me and what I've gathered from treating many patients over the years, is that it's very important to bring someone with you when you go to the doctor for the first time. And that's because you may understand and appreciate everything that's being told to you, but it, because of everything that you do get a lot of information at once, and it would be very, very helpful to have someone there that can take notes so that you can really listen. And so I think it's very important to bring someone with you to the appointment, so that you have someone else to, to, that can be there for you to help digest the information that you've learned later on once you leave, because always there'll be many, many questions that you want to ask and may forget to ask them at the time. So in terms of navigating colorectal cancer step by step, you want to ask a lot of questions. And don't be afraid to ask questions, because that's how you're going to get information, and that's how you're going to learn about your diagnosis, learn about the correct treatments and what the treatments are and what the side effects are. And so it's very important to ask questions. So in terms of the questions to ask, a lot of this was mentioned already in terms of how we advise patients about therapies to take. But what you want to ask is, where is my cancer? What stage is my cancer in? Where has it spread to? What organs has it spread to? Is there any other further classification of the cancer that I need to know about? And that was mentioned with these special protein tests or markers that were mentioned already by Dr. Saltz about the cancer, different protein markers, different tumor markers. And ultimately, yes, you do want to ask about prognosis. Some people don't want to know the information. Some people do. But you would want to ask your doctor specifically about that. I do think that it is important to get a second opinion for your cancer, just to make sure that the diagnosis is correct and that your that the pathology is correct and that you feel more comfortable that you understand that everything is going down the right path and that you're getting the correct medicines and correct recommendations for treatment. In terms of gathering information about your disease and how it's important to gather information so that you can ask the right questions, you want to ask your treatment team, whether it's the nurse or the doctor, about the different kinds of treatments that are offered. How are these treatments delivered? You want to ask them about clinical trials. Is there a specific trial for my stage of cancer and for my specific treatment? And also, is there a clinical trial for my specific time in treatment? Some clinical trials only allow patients that have had no prior therapy on, and other clinical trials allow patients that have had prior therapies, so testing new drugs. So you would want to ask your doctor about that as well. And lastly, in terms of evaluating your treatment options, it's very important to communicate with your doctor about all the options available to you. What are the pros and cons of each treatment option? What are the side effects? How will those side effects be managed? We have made a lot of breakthroughs in terms of managing side effects from these chemotherapy drugs. And for the most part, the chemotherapies given for colorectal cancer are pretty well tolerated, all in all. But do require supportive care therapies to manage side effects. And I just want to highlight it that your multidisciplinary team of doctors is your team of doctors and specialists and supportive care professionals that are working together to treat your disease and so that you get the best outcome. And so don't be afraid to ask them any questions about your specific case, about a new drug that someone else may have told you about to ask about, don't be afraid to ask questions. And I think I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions that you have later.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ocean. That was wonderful and very important to highlight the importance of the communication and the ability to ask questions. So that's really important information for everyone to have. Thank you. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Mark Pachapin. Dr. Pachapin is Director, Division of Gastroenterology. Schultz leads Professor of Gastroenterology, Professor of Medicine, NYU Langone Medical Center. And Dr. Pachapin is going to address follow-up care and guidelines for screening. Dr. Pachapin?
Thank you. It's a pleasure and privilege to be part of this call. And Carolyn, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to everybody. I'm the one gastroenterologist of the group, and what I want to discuss are three scenarios of follow-up and screening. Follow-up generally means that something's been found, either a growth like a polyp or a cancer, and screening means someone who wants to try and prevent either the polyp forming into a cancer or the cancer developing. So let me start first with a patient who has had the diagnosis of colorectal cancer and had the colon cancer resected. That means usually surgically resected and then may or may not be undergoing the medical therapy, the chemotherapy I was described. So for a patient who has a cancer, sometimes when the cancer is diagnosed, it's actually blocking the lining of the colon such that the way we screen using a colonoscope uses an instrument, which is a long flexible tube that has a light on the end and is attached to a video camera. If that tube cannot get past where the cancer is in the colon, sometimes it has to be removed, meaning the tumor has to be removed surgically, and that the part of the colon that was in front of that cancer was never looked at via a colonoscopy. So in that case, after the surgery is done, sometimes we may even need to go back 2 or 3 months after the surgery to look at the part of the colon that was not seen. However, if the colon cancer, when it was diagnosed, was able to be passed by the colonoscope during the colonoscopy and the whole colon was looked at, then generally we go back about a year after the resection of the cancer. After that year, then the recommendations may vary from patient to patient based on the findings, but the general recommendations is after the first year that the next screening colonoscopy in the patient with colon cancer would be 3 years, and if that's normal, then possibly 5 years and every 5 years after that. Now, I have to say, in all truth, very often these guidelines are going to be modified to the type of cancer, the family history, and perhaps even the genetic component in which the patient's cancer is diagnosed. So, for example, there is a condition known as Lynch syndrome, which is a genetic syndrome. It's also known as HNPCC, or hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer syndrome. And for these patients, they would need to undergo a colonoscopy every year because, in fact, the colon cancer can develop at a much quicker rate than patients who don't have that syndrome. So for patients who have had cancer, it's often in discussion and would be changed potentially based on what the determination is by their oncologist and their surgeon. Now, for patients who have a polyp, we're talking now about not a cancer, but something that has the potential of turning cancer. And that's what we have to understand. The concept of preventing colon cancer is actually finding a polyp in the colon that has the potential risk of turning into cancer. Not all polyps turn cancerous, but we think most cancers actually come from polyps. So the concept is to find a polyp, and there are really two specific types of polyps that have the risk of turning cancerous. One is called an adenoma, and the other is called a sessile serrated polyp. When we find these polyps, we remove them at the time of a colonoscopy. And by the way, all these scenarios that I'm discussing require colonoscopy because they're for patients who are at increased risk. So if a polyp is found, I always say it's one-stop shopping. The polyp is removed if it can be, and then it's sent to the lab so that we can look to see whether this is the type of polyp that potentially had the risk of turning cancerous. So in patients who have had a polyp, if the polyp is larger than 1 centimeter, then the follow-up would usually be about 3 years after the removal of that polyp. If the polyp is smaller than 1 centimeter, then the usual follow-up recommendation is either 5 years or even longer. So that's if you have a polyp. Now, the final category are for family members of patients who've had colon cancer or potentially large polyps. Now, these family members are considered themselves at increased risk. And so colon cancer or colon polyps are actually something that you need to know about in your family history. And this is something that we've been doing even at a national level, really promoting patients and people to empower themselves and know their family history. So once you know that there's a family history of someone in your family who had colorectal cancer, the recommended screening, as long as the patient is usually under the age of 65 or so, there's some debate as to what the age should be, but if there's a younger patient in the family, particularly under the age of 65, who's had colorectal cancer, the recommended screening starts at age 40. Or 10 years younger than the youngest member who had the cancer. So let's say somebody had cancer at age 45, then screening may start at age 35. I always actually emphasize that patients who have young people in their family who've had colorectal cancer should speak to their doctors about potential genetic counseling, because there may be one of these familial cancer syndromes as I described. So age 40 with a family history, or 10 years younger than the youngest family member. And if, in fact, somebody has no family risk at all, then that's when you probably hear the national guidelines suggest age 50. So those are the recommended screening guidelines, and they're always considered guidelines. If there are people in your family who've had multiple polyps or multiple different cancers, sometimes other cancers may be affiliated with that Lynch syndrome, like a uterine cancer or an ovarian cancer in women, the most important thing is to talk to your doctor and have your doctor come up with you to develop the guidelines that make sense for your particular situation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Pachapin. That's very helpful to people to understand all of this, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Martha Raymond, and Ms. Raymond is the Patient Support and Outreach Director, Colon Cancer Alliance, and she's going to address with you the role of the Colon Cancer Alliance. Ms. Raymond?
Great. Thanks, Carolyn, and thank you to our amazing panel. Just wonderful, very helpful information for all patients. It's my pleasure to be here today representing the Colon Cancer Alliance. As Carolyn mentioned, I'm the Patient Support and Outreach Director at the Colon Cancer Alliance, where I have the privilege of working with our compassionate and professional staff of patient support advocates and navigators. Our goal at the CCA is to educate, empower, and support colon cancer patients, their families, and caregivers by providing support services and educational programs. A few of the services we provide are our toll-free helpline that averages just about 1,000 calls per month, our peer-to-peer support buddy program, our online support community, our chat room, our financial assistance programs for screening and for those in treatment, and our new patient support navigator program. Our navigator program is a one-of-a-kind program in the national colon cancer advocacy community that supports patients throughout the care continuum. We are here to help. Please know that you are not alone. And for more information, please don't hesitate to call our helpline at 877-422-2030 or visit our website at ccalliance.org. Again, I'd like to thank everybody at Cancer Care, and it's just been a privilege working with everybody. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Martha. That's wonderful, and it's a wonderful resource for everybody, so please do take advantage of that wonderful resource. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. Liz is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. She's program coordinator here at Cancer Care, and she's going to address the free psychosocial support services that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with colorectal cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained on how to diagnose a cancer, how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are always trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and the psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker at Cancer Care for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a colorectal patient support group over the phone as well as online and a general telephone and online support group for caregivers. We have unique young adult caregivers groups as well. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As you have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to discuss, to digest, and to understand and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information you need. Again, please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services can help, and we're here for you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you very much, Liz. That was wonderful. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And I just want to say, if we don't get your question, please call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. I'll repeat that again at the end of the call. But let's see how many questions we can take right now. So, Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from George S. Your line is open.
Hi there. We just have a question with respect to some products that were recommended to us from some relatives over in Europe. I don't know how prevalent they call it this wheatgrass product, which I guess is some type of powder that you add to water and you drink it in the mornings, and some very high legume, or I'm not sure the proper way to describe it. I'm sure you guys have heard about it and want to get your thoughts on how effective that is for long-term care.
Thank you for your question. Dr. Saltz, is that something you want to address?
Sure, I'd be happy to. One of the challenges that all patients face when they reach cancer diagnosis is the well-intended help that comes from all quarters, relatives, friends, and articles for everything from Lancet and New England Journal of Medicine to the National Enquirer and various far reaches of the Internet. And it's very, very hard to sort out reality from wish. As I mentioned before, I really do believe we have compelling evidence that diet matters and nutrition matters, and I do strongly advocate the kind of prudent diet that I discussed earlier. But specific dietary supplements, I'm very skeptical about. There's you have to remember that there's a significant business motivation behind the marketing of these things. They are virtually never tested with any kind of study that I would regard as meaningful, because they're studies that can't fail. They're single arm. We did this and look what happened, and isn't that great? Overall, I don't recommend dietary supplements. I don't recommend extra use of vitamins or any particular product of that nature, but rather a balanced, healthy diet, largely vegetarian, pescatarian, high in fresh fruits, vegetables, and seafood, and low in red meat and animal fats.
Thank you very much. And we have a question from one of our online participants, and the question is the new ColoGuard screening test for colorectal polyps and tumors receives FDA approval, is it appropriate as part of the follow-up exam for patients who have had a non-metastatic rectal tumor years ago and is now has no evidence of disease? Dr. Pachapin, can you address that?
Sure. So there's been some news, a new test that has combined a DNA marker and a marker for human hemoglobin or blood in the stool, looking to see if we could find early cancer. It's particularly meant for the diagnosis of early cancer at a time when it would be more easily cured by resection at a lower stage. That test right now is one that, given that it's new, is really being considered for the average risk screening population of patients who might be unwilling to undergo a colonoscopy, and perhaps with time maybe even a substitute as a way of screening average risk patients. I think at the current time, though, I would not look at some of the less invasive tests for patients who are considered at high risk, which was really the people I was addressing, patients who particularly either have had colorectal cancer, who've had significant polyps, or are related at a first degree. When I say family member, I'm really talking about a first degree relative, a brother, a sister, a parent, or a child of someone who's had colorectal cancer. So although I think these things are very exciting, particularly for average risk, I think in the population we're describing, probably would wait till we have some more data suggesting its use.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And another question that's from one of our online participants. What should I know before surgery for colorectal cancer? Dr. Ryan, can you address that?
Sure. So I would talk to your surgeon about how long you expect to stay in the hospital, whether someone's going to have a temporary ostomy, either an ileostomy or a colostomy, whether the surgeon thinks the tumor is in the rectum or the colon, and is there any sense that the cancer is localized, locally advanced, or metastatic? I would say those are the big questions to ask your surgeon.
And another question from one of our online participants. I completed my treatment for colon cancer chemotherapy 6 months ago. However, I still have lingering cold sensitivity. Will I always have this, or is there some treatment available to help with this symptom? Dr. Saltz, can you address that?
Sure. So with that discussion, I assume that you had an oxaliplatin-containing regimen, which would be standard for treatment of stage 3. Oxaliplatin is a drug that became part of standard practice in the United States about a dozen years ago or so. And we've been learning over time that it carries some potential long-term neurologic toxicities that we have to be concerned about. It causes a cold sensitivity in the hands, the feet, and the throat, and a numbness and tingling in the hands and feet. What we've learned is that if we look at the data from the original registration study, about 30% of patients have some degree of neuropathy a year after their last dose of oxaliplatin. Not a year after surgery, but a year after their last dose. So turning that around, 70% of people a year out will have lost all cold sensitivity and numbness and tingling, but 30% will still have something. And about 15% have that as a very long-term issue. It's still present at 4 years, and at that point we would have to regard it as permanent. Fortunately, the overwhelming majority of those patients, it's a very low-grade kind of minor background annoyance. It's very rare for it to be something that really is a substantial imposition on somebody's life to have long-term serious neurotoxicity. unfortunately, we really don't have anything that helps. And attempts at treating with the various drugs that treat neuropathies not only don't help, but have their own side effects and can cause their own problems, especially including sedation. Because the drugs that are on the market that treat neuropathy, such as Lyrica, Neurontin, Cymbalta, things of that nature, treat the pain fibers. And it's vanishingly rare for oxaliplatin to cause a painful neuropathy. The cold sensitivity and the paresthesias or numbness and tingling are simply different nerve fibers that those drugs don't affect. So trying them is something that I've stopped doing over the past 5 years or so. We had enough failures to feel comfortable that it just doesn't work, and all of them, as I say, are somewhat sedating. We used to think that doses of calcium or magnesium might help during the treatment, but we now have very solid data to show that those don't make any difference at all. So unfortunately, if the neuropathy is present, there isn't really much we can do about it. And what we've learned as oncologists over the past decade or so to do is to pull back from the dose when we see early signs of the neuropathy becoming a problem.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants. What clinical trials are looking promising for patients who have exhausted all current drugs? Dr. Ryan, could you address that?
Sure. So I would say that most of us who are in large academic cancer centers are looking at drugs that target specific pathways, and we're testing patients' individual tumors for either overexpression of those pathways or a mutation of a gene that encodes one of those pathways. Those, I would say, are the most promising drugs or combination of drugs that we're looking at. The other broad category of drugs, which unfortunately for most of the GI cancers hasn't proven to be beneficial, are the new agents targeting the immune system in cancer. There have been some potential or anecdotal responses, but for the GI cancers, there seems to be something a little bit more complicated than, say, for melanoma or lung cancer. But ongoing work at many major centers continues with regards to those immune-targeting drugs.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been quite an enormous, wonderful faculty of speakers. We really have had many different, I think as Dr. Ocean had said, a very multidisciplinary team of speakers. This is wonderful to have today. I want to thank our speakers. I want to thank all of you who've been listening and who've actually asked questions, both online and on the telephone as well. And I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program. And that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So I do want to remind all of you that you can access help from Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. Our staff are here also to answer your questions. If you didn't get to ask your question, please do contact our staff. They would be happy to follow up with you on any questions or concerns you may have. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with colorectal cancer. I want you to know that you're now part of this support area of cancer care, and I want you to know that we're here to help you. We also have also called out the Colon Cancer Alliance as they're also a wonderful resource for all of you to take advantage of as well. So please do, and all the other organizations as well, please know that you are not alone, that we are all here to help you. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone, have a wonderful day.